welcome to this audio edition of Philip Pusher's program notes for upcoming concerts by the Chicago Symphony Orchestra. I'm Rich Caparella, and concerts by the CSO on Thursday, June 5th through Saturday, the 7th, feature guest conductor Sir Mark Elder and violin soloist Randall Goosby. The program includes Prokofiev's Symphony No. 7, Violin Concerto No. 2 by Florence Price, and a suite from Die Meistersinger von Nuremberg by Richard Wagner. Here are program notes by guest annotator Daniel Jaffe on Prokofiev's Symphony No. 7, a work lasting about 31 minutes. Sergei Prokofiev composed his seventh and final symphony in 1952 to a commission from the Children's Programming Division of the Soviet State Radio Committee, or to give its official title of that time, Radio Information Committee. This alone would explain its clear-cut melodious style, the often sparkling and attractive orchestration, and the several touches of mystery, as well as the enchantment of its fairy tale world. The composer of Peter and the Wolf was, of course, no stranger to young audiences, and indeed, Prokofiev originally designated his seventh as a children's symphony. He dropped that title, apparently persuaded that the work was suitable for a mature audience, but also perhaps in tacit acknowledgement of the seventh disturbing undercurrents, notwithstanding its surface charm. Take its very opening, a somber theme played by the first violins, accompanied simply by a bare octave from horns and tuba. Something so stark and serious was quite contrary to the then prevailing fashion in 1950s Stalinist Russia of presenting something breezily upbeat, perhaps in the style of one of Kabalevsky's youth concertos, his third piano concerto being a fine example. And then there's the curious Glockenspiel theme, first heard in the symphony's opening movement, which then pops up virtually as the symphony's final word. Yet, in the main, Prokofiev's Seventh appears a standard four-movement symphony, in its own way modeled after Shostakovich's landmark officially endorsed Fifth. That work, if anything, starts with an even more grave and serious theme, which presumably gave Prokofiev the courage to write such an opening for his Symphony No. 7. Indeed, Prokofiev had already followed the example of Shostakovich's Fifth in his own Symphony No. 5 from 1944, with his own take on the craggy and heroic tone of Shostakovich's first movement, followed by a somewhat unnerving scherzo, a lamenting slow movement, and a rousing finale. In many respects, although the Seventh sounds a quite different work, it follows the same sequence of movements, albeit with a different finale. In its original form, rather daringly, Prokofiev repeated the formula used in his Sixth Symphony's finale, notably the return of a first movement theme in its finale, followed by a downbeat ending, though the Seventh, as Prokofiev originally conceived it, ends in a whisper rather than with a thunderous final cadence. Such a move was all the more reckless, since the Sixth Symphony, 1945 through 47, with its unmistakably tragic trajectory, was one of the very works cited as evidence against Prokofiev when, during the notorious Conference of Musicians, chaired by Andrei Dzyanov in January 1948, he was condemned as a leading formalist. His Sixth Symphony, now widely recognized as one of his greatest symphonic achievements, was banned from performance, as were his three great so-called war sonatas for piano and a number of other specified works. With concert managers fearful of programming music by this now disgraced composer, the practical upshot was that for some years, virtually nothing of Prokofiev's was performed, and he suddenly found himself in virtual poverty. Furthermore, he was already in poor health, having been diagnosed just a few years earlier as having chronic high blood pressure. Even with the steadfast support of two young musicians, cellist Mstislav Rostropovich and pianist Sviatoslav Richter, Prokofiev was in desperate need of rehabilitation, a necessary step before he could once again earn his living as a composer. He was finally saved by the previously mentioned Children's Programming Division of the Radio Committee. His first commission from that institution, however, was not his Seventh Symphony, but a cantata, On Guard for Peace, essentially a propaganda work involving orchestra, soloist, and a children's choir. Prokofiev composed this under close supervision from a member of the Central Committee and Supreme Soviet, the writer Alexander Fadayev, and fulfilled it in an uncharacteristically mawkish style. On Guard for Peace was premiered in December 1950. It was performed again in the concert in which his Seventh Symphony was premiered October 11, 1952. In attending this, Prokofiev made his last public appearance. The juxtaposition of those two works surely made the Seventh Symphony's darker undercurrents and disquieting details the more striking. We've already noted its opening theme, though admittedly it is also a retreat from the overt anguish expressed in Prokofiev's previous symphony. Here is something dignified and restrained, appropriate for someone who has lived and survived a tumultuous era, as had Prokofiev and his contemporaries, yet is now prepared to keep his own counsel. There follows a more agitated episode involving exchanges between woodwinds and strings, then an apparently warm-hearted theme rising from the bass strings, reinforced by horns and lower woodwinds, one that might easily and quite obviously to the premier audience have come from On Guard for Peace. The initial combination of such a baritone theme with moderately intricate string tracery may recall perhaps the balcony scene from Prokofiev's Romeo and Juliet, but this is soon replaced with glittering but rather soulless piano figuration, the equivalent of a smile once instigated by feeling but now exercised insincerely. Further cold water arrives in the form of the Glockenspiel theme, an allusion to the astrologer's theme in the Golden Cockerel, the last opera by Prokofiev's former teacher, Rimsky-Korsakov. The development section begins with a fragment of the astrologer's theme, which seems to linger even through sudden flurries from flutes and violins and impatient nudges from bass and snare drums. The recapitulation, strangely inconclusive, ends with a far from clinching minor chord. In contrast, the second movement, Allegretto, appears charming and carefree as we enter an enchanted fairy tale style ballroom Prokofiev created so effectively in his earlier ballet score, Cinderella. Yet, midway through that movement, the music seems to lose its way as first violins, then a solo oboe play an absent-minded, emotionally numbed theme. Eventually, goaded by a hectoring snare drum, the music whips itself up into a final frenzy. The slow movement recycles a theme from incidental music to Eugene Onegin, composed in 1936 for a never-fulfilled production intended to mark the centenary of Pushkin's death. That theme's wistful character is apposite on several levels to the young Tatiana and her feelings for the anti-hero and to the tender recollection of a lost past, both that of Pushkin's and also, with hindsight, of the optimistic year 1936 when Prokofiev had finally chosen to return to Russia with his family. The orchestration becomes increasingly spare and brittle as Prokofiev's recollection of a graceful but now past style seems to ossify as we listen. The xylophone only adds to the stiff-limbed impression as if the music no longer manifested living, breathing humans but mere puppets or automatons. Like the Sixth Symphony, the finale appears initially to cast care away, this time in the form of a frantic gallop, but eventually appears to lose energy and is replaced with a would-be triumphal march, just as that too seems to be rather graphically running out of steam. The On Guard for Peace style theme returns. This is followed, inevitably, by the astrologer's theme, which, with apparent melancholy resignation, has the final word, as the piano ticks away what time remains. In Rimsky-Korsakov's opera, likewise, it is the astrologer who has the last word, telling the audience that, while he himself is real, the absurd and autocratic Tsar Dodon, together with his court, were an illusion, a dream, a pale shadow, nothing. One can imagine how Prokofiev applied this to the world he was so soon to leave. So Prokofiev intended his symphony to end, but after the premiere, the conductor, Samuil Samosud, told the composer what members of the committee for the lucrative Stalin Prize had told him, that the symphony's downbeat ending precluded it winning the first prize, if he would just write a more positive ending. Being in great need of the money, Prokofiev obliged by adding an upbeat coda, but died before the award could be made, but not before he begged Rostropovich and perhaps other close colleagues to ensure that the original ending was reinstated. Program notes by guest annotator Daniel Jaffe on Prokofiev's Symphony No. 7. And now on to Florence Price's Violin Concerto No. 2, a work lasting about 16 minutes. On Tuesday afternoon, November 24, 1964, the Florence B. Price School at 4351 South Drexel Boulevard in Chicago's Kenwood neighborhood was dedicated. The pupils of grade 2 sang Price's song, It's Snowing, and then Price's Violin Concerto No. 2, which she had not lived to hear, was performed in an arrangement for violin and piano. The soloist was Price's friend and the woman for whom she wrote the concerto, Minnie Cedergreen Jernberg. By 1964, Florence Price was regularly overlooked by the music world, and her groundbreaking achievement as the first black woman to have her music played by one of the great American orchestras, the Chicago Symphony, more than 30 years earlier, was largely forgotten. But in Chicago, her reputation was still substantial enough that her name was given to a new elementary school with 37 classrooms and kindergartens, an auditorium, gymnasium, a library, and a lunchroom. Today's Price's story has taken its place as one of the pivotal chapters in American music. Her renaissance was jump-started in 2009 with the discovery in an old dilapidated house in St. Anne, Illinois, a tiny community little more than an hour south of Chicago, that was once Price's summer house, long ago abandoned. A couple had recently purchased the property and were planning to renovate. Inside, they found boxes filled with yellowing pages of music and scattered piles of musical manuscripts, all with Florence Price's name on them. Over the next years, her music suddenly began to be played and heard and published, and the astonishing story of her discovery in Chicago came to light once again. Florence Price moved from Little Rock to Chicago with her family in 1927, making the Great Migration, followed by thousands of black Americans fleeing the terrors of living in the South and hoping to find a land of opportunity here. She already saw herself as part of a larger musical world. In 1903, she entered the New England Conservatory of Music in Boston, and she completed her four-year program in 3 years, graduating with diplomas in both piano and organ, the only student to receive 2 degrees that year. After graduation, Florence set aside her musical ambitions and returned to Little Rock to teach and live at home with her parents. She moved from one teaching job to another, continued to give organ and piano recitals, married Thomas Jewell Price, started a family, and settled into a comfortable middle-class life in a predominantly black neighborhood in Little Rock. She spent the summers of 1926 and 27 in Chicago, where she studied composition at Chicago Musical College, and no doubt realized that this was the place to build her career and live a better life, remote from the rising racial tension in Little Rock. But even in Chicago, composing music did not come easily. After the Depression, her husband was often without work. He grew angry and abusive. He moved out of the family home in March 1930. The next January, Florence was granted a divorce and custody of their 2 daughters, and she began the score that would change her life, a symphony in E minor, her first big orchestral piece. As she struggled to put her life back together and become the composer she wanted to be in a world that viewed her through a prism of fierce prejudices, she cannot have dreamed that the most unlikely thing would happen, that Frederick Stock, and the Chicago Symphony Orchestra would give the world premiere of her symphony at the 1933 World's Fair, the Century of Progress Exposition. In February 1932, Price had entered four of her new works in the Rodman Wanamaker competition named after the department store owner and established 5 years earlier to support African-American composers. Price's symphony took the $500 first prize in the orchestral category. That same year, Stock was named music advisor for the exposition set in Chicago to honor the city's centennial, and he began to look around for new scores that would represent the state of music in America. Although Stock did not know Price, he picked her unpublished First Symphony as the centerpiece of a concert to be given on June 15, 1933, in the Auditorium Theater. We have since learned that Maud Roberts George, the president of the Chicago Music Association and a critic for the Chicago Defender, raised funds to underwrite the cost of the concert. No one could have sat through that program and not felt with a sense of deep satisfaction that the race is making progress in music, wrote Robert Abbott, editor of the Chicago Defender, arguably the most important and most widely read black publication in America at the time. Dressed in a long white gown, Price was called to the stage again and again after the performance to share the enthusiastic response with Stock and the orchestra members. History was made that night and then largely forgotten. For the next two decades, Price's career proceeded as an ongoing struggle to gain recognition. As she wrote to Serge Koussevitzky, music director for the Boston Symphony Orchestra and a pioneering champion of new music, "I have two handicaps, those of sex and race. I am a woman, and I have some Negro blood in my veins. I should like to be judged on merit alone." By the time of her death in 1953, those were still formidable obstacles in the American music world, and Price had made little headway in establishing the reputation she so richly deserved. The manuscripts discovered in St. Anne in 2009 contained several lost works, including two violin concertos and a fourth symphony, music that came painfully close to vanishing forever. When the violin concertos were recorded in 2017, there were no previous performances of the first. It has sometimes been claimed that the second violin concerto was played for the first time at the Kenwood School dedication ceremony in 1964. But just 5 months after Price's death, the Chicago Tribune reported that Jernberg would play the unknown concerto at a memorial concert in Curtis Hall in the Fine Arts Building just two blocks south of Orchestra Hall on November 3, 1953. In 1953, shortly before her death, Price mentioned that she was now writing the kind of music that was closest to her heart. She had recently finished the second violin concerto, her last major work. It shows Price venturing in a new direction. Where her first violin concerto, written in 1939, just 6 years after the historic Chicago premiere of her first symphony, is structured in the three conventional movements, this new concerto is written in a single large span of music. The solo violin enters early after only a few measures of stately, harmonically unsettling curtain-raising gestures from the orchestra with a rhapsodic outpouring, a kind of introductory cadenza. That leads directly into jaunty, rhythmically propulsive music shared by violin and orchestra. The second big paragraph is prime Price in its haunting lyricism and utterly individual harmonic progressions. The piece continues with imagination and ingenuity to shift between these two musical worlds. Throughout, Price writes with surprising confidence in her own voice. She has fully absorbed the influence of various kinds of black music, including the lilt and harmonic cut of the spiritual, without quoting or imitating. In 1938, before composing her first violin concerto, she wrote presciently that we were on the brink of establishing a national musical idiom. "We are waking up to the fact, pregnant with possibilities, that we already have a folk music in Negro spirituals." With this work in particular, she made that hope a beautiful reality. Two postscripts Minnie Cedergreen-Jernberg, the violinist who introduced the second violin concerto that Price wrote for her, died in 1967 in Blue Island, Illinois. In 2011, Chicago public school officials closed Florence B. Price Elementary after 4 years of chronic poor performance on state standardized tests. A piano that had reportedly belonged to Price was still housed in the building. Program notes by Philip Huscher on Florence Price's Violin Concerto No. 2. I'm Richard Caparella. Thanks for listening.